Tato, and welcome to South Pacific Muscle. Today, truly blessed to have my fucking good friend, Bryn Ealy, who I haven't seen for a long, long time. Welcome on board, my bro.
Cheers, Nate. Cheers, Mike. How are you guys doing?
Pretty good here, bro.
Living the dream.
Living the dream. Secondary teacher, you sure, bro? You sure?
That's been my stock answer for about the last 4 or 5 years. There's just varying degrees of sarcasm when I say it. At the moment, there's not too much. It's pretty good.
Good times. Hey, for those that don't know Bryn, Bryn, I met way back in when I sort of came back into bodybuilding, and Bryn was a skinny little fella, and I remember seeing him do his first bodybuilding show, and I actually remember being quite blown away by how much progress Bryn had made. But to be fair, while I've been off the scene and coming back at having a look at some of his achievements in powerlifting, I was absolutely blown away. So what I think I might do is let Bryn sort of talk a bit about himself, a bit about the early days, because he's a man of international flavor. Tell us where he grew up and that type of thing, and then talk us about how he got into early sports and training, and give us a bit of history. So I'll hand over to you, Bryn.
Cheers, Nate. Yeah, so basically, I was born in Japan, so my mother's Japanese. And my dad is, he's originally from Liverpool, so he came to Christchurch on the boats with my grandparents when he was five with his sister. So I'm half Scouser, half Japanese. Christchurch raised with a Welsh first name, a Japanese middle name, and an Irish last name.
Oh, God, bro. You're a mongrel. Yeah,
pretty much. So my ancestors were from Waterford, Ireland, because I did all the family tree. So they were from Waterford, Ireland, and then they moved to Liverpool during the potato famine in the 1800s. So that's kind of my heritage on my dad's side is Irish and English, and my mum's side is Japanese, but mixed in there too, because my granddad, he was born on a Russian island called Sakhalin.
Wow.
Yeah, and my great-granddad, he went to the Siberian War. My granddad went to the war in China. So I've got military lineage on my mum's side as well.
I reckon Irish, Scouser, and Japanese might be the ideal mix for a fighter.
Yeah, probably the temper. And, you know, like, so just going back, my brother, my older brother, he was a professional fighter. And my other brother, he's a professional rugby player in Japan. So we all kind of grew up, because my dad's a rugby man himself, we all kind of grew up doing rugby and kind of playing sport, but he put us all into judo when we were young, and myself and my oldest brother gravitated towards that, and my middle brother gravitated towards rugby, and then eventually I was competing in judo as well, and then I got injured when I was about 17, and then I started getting into rehab and that, and then my judo coach, one of my judo coaches at the time, was a personal trainer, and he had mentioned to me about the gym and things like that, and I had mentors like my dad's friends who were involved in rugby at the time, so strength and conditioning coaches. Mm-hmm. So from a very young age, I was kind of surrounded by athletes. So from a young age around, yeah, probably around that 17, 18 mark, I started to become quite fascinated with muscle and getting stronger.
You've got like listening to your background, you know, like there's no surprise that you've ended up being a strength and conditioning coach, but with some specialization towards the fighting side of things and with athletes, because you're just immersed in it from day dot by the sound of it.
Yeah, well, I guess, so my pivotal moment for me was one of my dad's very close friends was the former All Blacks and Crusaders strength and conditioning coach, Ashley mm-hmm. Jones.
Yep.
So I saw my first ever weight training program from him when I was 14. And I asked him, I remember he came over to my house.
Yeah.
And I asked him, oh, what do you do for work? And he said, oh, I help people perform better. And I just became obsessed. I was like, oh, what do you do? And every time he came over, I would say, Can you show me like a program you do? And he gave me a full body, you know, a very like deadlift, squat, upper body push, upper body pull, and things like that. And he just said, you know, this is what a beginner's program would look like. Do that 3 times a week. And then I started to kind of think about, okay, is this how you train? And then, yeah, when I started to pick up weights, I had a few other people around me to guide me. And, you know, yourself included, like I remember one thing, you probably remember this. So a quote that you told me was, if you want to get something done, send it to a busy person.
Yeah, bro.
Do you remember saying that? I remember you told me from day one.
Yeah, I stole it off someone else, but yeah, words I use for sure, bro. I thought I was a bit scared there for a minute because I thought you were going to tell a story. I was thinking, fuck, don't tell a story, bro. Don't tell a story.
Which story?
I was thinking about the viaduct.
Yeah, so that's kind of, so this is, yeah, so this is, I guess, where I guess you and I have come full circle, Nate. Yeah, so yeah. An interesting story. You helped me out a lot when I was first getting started. Yeah. And I guess for me, growing up, I was picked on a lot as a kid at school because I was different, you know? So weight training for me became one of those things where I was like, okay, it's my thing, one thing that I can control, and I'll just put everything into it. So I had that kind of mindset growing up where I had a lot of people tell me I couldn't do stuff, so I just wanted to prove them wrong. But then eventually, like, I had people like you and other people who just supported me. So, you know, and now
I think a lot of us saw something in you that was probably quite unique. It was that you were willing to learn and willing to listen, and you were incredibly humble. And to be fair, in the scene that we were in at the time, there was a lot of ego-driven people, and and I think, you know, like yourself and Kagan Orton were two examples of guys that, you know, that really were always humble, always respectful. And, you know, to be fair, we probably learned as much from you as you did from us at the time about how we should carry ourselves in society and within our sport. So, you know, it's always a two-way street, the learning process, you know?
Yeah, and I guess, so a lot of my training philosophies and a lot of my philosophies around coaching have, I guess, come from people like yourself, but also my upbringing. So my dad, he was ex-military, so he was Territorial Forces.
Yep.
And then, like I said earlier, my granddad went to China for war, and my great-granddad went to Siberian War. So I had, I guess, a very heavy black and white influence from a young age. So I remember my dad telling me, you know, he said, if you're going to ask someone for help, you better listen. Otherwise, don't ask them because you're going to waste their time.
That's a great piece of advice.
You know, and I remember a good mutual friend of ours, I was actually talking to him about it the other day, and I learned a lot through a lot of the old school bodybuilders, because for me, it was one of those things where, you know, some of the leg sessions, some of the sessions that I've done, it's been a test like of mental character for me. And I've always liked that challenge of people going, oh, I doubt you can do it. And in my mind, I'm like, I'm going to show you.
Yeah, hard. Bro, if I went back then and, you know, even as I said, when I saw you doing the bodybuilding show, I was absolutely amazed at what you had managed to put on that stage. But now, looking at the fact that, you know, I looked and you'd pulled a 300 deadlift. I've never pulled a 300 deadlift, and I've tried my fucking ass off, and I'm like, holy shit, you know, the amount of dedication and fortitude that you've shown to achieve some of these things is pretty fucking incredible, and I guess testament to that character and perhaps the, you know, the upbringing and those people around you that have sort of really, really, you know, driven that work ethic into you, which, you know, I think you had to have back in the days when we were training in Christchurch, because I think everyone was, you know, pushing everyone as hard as they could, and those that hung in and survived seemed to do well in whatever challenge they took on.
Yeah, and I guess also, Nate, like, you know a lot of a lot of friends of mine. So one of my close friends that I've known for a long time, Jordan Earl.
Yep.
So when we grew up, you know, he obviously had these goals of being Mr. New Zealand and things like that. And I still remember to this day, me, him and Tom Mack, we were at the Rich Gaspari and Hira Yamagishi seminar in Auckland. And, you know, Jordan looked at me and he goes, "Oh, bro, do I look big? How do I look?" I remember those days. But, yeah.
You've got some good friends too, bro. I've got to say, the names that you throw, as soon as you said Tom Mack, I just couldn't help laughing. Old Tommy Two Guns. Love to catch up with that guy again. I've lost sort of touch with him, but Jordan Earl, he was kind enough to send me a thing, a pre-workout. So I got a new pre-workout to try today. I'm not going to tell anyone the name of it, but it's a pre-workout, and oh my God, I felt like I was fucking tripping. It was so strong. Yeah. It was nuts. You've hit some really cool people around you along the way, but you know, you've certainly, you know, become your own man, and you know, you've got a lot of people sort of looking towards you now because of the knowledge you have. So just want to quickly give us a quick overview of first days in bodybuilding and then moving to powerlifting and some of the achievements along the way.
Yeah, so I guess for me, because even though when I was younger, I was always kind of like the skinny fat kid.
Mm.
You know, like I put on body fat easy and I've never really been lean. So my first show that I ever went and watched, Daniel Hibbs was on stage. And I saw that and I was like, shit, I want to be that conditioned. You know, and then in my mind, I kind of didn't really have any idea of what bodybuilding was, except, okay, that's what you can look like. And then I kind of thought to myself, okay, like, that's cool. And then I guess it wasn't until I met Dave Smith.
Yep.
And I was like, okay, this is bodybuilding.
Yeah, man. He was an early mentor for me as well. You know, and Carmen back in the day when Carmen was around, you know, I just sort of used to look at awe at them. And they kind of made you level up, didn't they? You know?
Yeah, yeah. So I guess for me, that was kind of my influence. But ultimately, when I did, I'm a very numerical person. So I love numbers.
Yep.
It's just the way that I tick. So when I first did my bodybuilding show, and Kent Gibson, he helped me with my diet. Yeah. Another big mentor of mine. I've looked up to him for years. He still helps me to this day. I put on body fat easy. So what I had to do to get that lean, it's not something that really appealed to me. So I was on, just to give people an idea, I was on half a cup of oats. That was my only source of carbs for maybe 12 weeks.
Holy
Every day. And I was doing 45 minutes cardio a day.
Bro, that hurts listening to that, man. That is some torturous shit. Was that just as much as, like, I hold Kent as someone who is the one of our top and probably most you know, he's not in the limelight. No, you know, a lot of people don't know who Kent is, but Kent is a phenomenal prep coach. But hearing that story, I'm never going to him.
Yeah, so pretty much he was straight with me from day one. And he said, look, your body type, he said, we're going to have to bring the carbs down and you're going to have to pound the cardio in order to get lean. So he said, if you want to do bodybuilding, you're going to have to accept the fact that that's what your body type responds to and that's what you have to do. So he was very black and white with me from day one. And he said, if you want to do bodybuilding, you better fucking be prepared to do all this stuff. So I did it for that prep.
Yep.
And then afterwards, I guess, I kind of looked at it and went, okay, my numbers went down a bit. And then I thought to myself, okay, well, what do I want to do? And then, you know, training in Christchurch at Eastside Barbell, things like that. I guess powerlifting for me had always been one of those things where you can be big and you can be strong, but you don't really have to worry too much about being lean.
Yeah.
I'm not saying it's an excuse to, you know, throw everything in the kitchen sink and eat whatever you want, because there's that flip side. Like, I'm not a big believer in people using powerlifting as an excuse to be fat. You know, like, but yeah, I guess that was kind of my transition. And then, yeah, from there, I went and worked in Japan with a professional rugby franchise for a year and a half.
Nice.
As a strength and conditioning.
How was that, bro?
Yeah, so for me, it's kind of a mixed bag. Like, the knowledge that I gained was real good.
Yep.
But I went... So, because I'm half Japanese, I've got a Japanese passport. I went on a Japanese passport. So, I worked as a Japanese citizen. And it wasn't really the greatest experience in terms of working.
Yep.
Just because for me, you know, I've grown up in Christchurch my whole life. And I speak, I read, and I can write Japanese pretty well. But for me, it was one of those things where I went over and... they expected me to know the culture inside out.
Yeah. Be very, very different to ours, wouldn't it?
Yeah, like I know most of the culture, but not in that sense of like a corporate setting.
Mm.
So an example for me, one of the big culture shocks for me was, you know, went to the cafeteria. This is a rugby team, so it was quite like a lad culture.
Mm. Mm.
And I was the youngest there, and we finished eating, and one of the players goes, "Oh, Bryn, you can put all our plates away." And I looked at him and I was like, "What?" And then one of my mates who was, he's from the American island of Japan that used to be occupied by America back in the day. He's from Okinawa and he spoke English. So he just said to me, he's like, "Bro, just do it. That's just what you're going to have to do."
That'll be hard being a New Zealand boy.
Yeah. So in my mind, I was like, yeah, they're calling me Japanese, but like I wasn't brought up this way. So there was a lot of conflict in my mind in that way. And I had always wanted to do that job, but I had just finished my degree and I was there with my mentor, but the conditions that I was supposed to work there on kind of changed. And for me, it was one of those things where I wasn't ready to look after a whole team. I just got out of uni. Yeah. So the deal was I was supposed to be with my mentor for the whole time. But obviously something went wrong with his contract. So he had to leave and he had to go elsewhere for work. So I was kind of, left in Schitt's Creek, kind of doing my best, but I gained a lot. So I'll give a shout out to one of my very good friends and mentors, Phil Mooney. He was the ex-Queensland Reds head coach, Otago, and now he works at Brisbane Grammar. He taught me pretty much everything I know about the coaching aspect.
Yep. Awesome, bro.
So, yeah, I guess what I've been able to do is I've been able to merge everything I learned over in Japan from my rugby mentors. And when I came back, so interesting story that I'll tell you. So, my mentor, Ashley Jones, he said to me a couple of weeks before he left for Scotland, he looked at me and I was down in the dumps because I knew he was leaving and I was like, shit scared. I don't know what I was going to do. And he goes, "Look, this is what you," he looked at me and he goes, "This is what you're going to do when you go back to New Zealand." And I said, "What?" He goes, "You're going to compete in the under 90 weight class. You're going to deadlift 300 kg. You're going to win national titles and you're going to set records." And I looked at this guy and I was like, what are you telling me? Because the situation at the time for me, I couldn't really comprehend why he was saying that.
Yeah.
And I caught up with him in January and now he's the head of performance at the Houston Sabercats in Texas.
Yeah.
And he said to me, he was like, "Do you remember that time we were in the gym and we had that chat?" And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "I said that to you because I wanted you to believe that you could do it." And then he said, "You ended up doing it."
Yeah, bro.
So that was pretty surreal for me once I actually did it. And I messaged him because pretty much what happened for me, this is like another pivotal moment. So when I the tail end of my time in Japan, I couldn't really train because I was just working way too much. So I said to myself, soon as I get off that plane, I'm getting in my garage and I'm going to train 6 days a week. And that's exactly what I started doing. That's just
funny,
bro.
It's funny, like, you know the old saying you know, in fight sports, but in other sports, is, you know, where the head goes, the body follows. I think that applies in a more, an overview sense. Like, you know, if your mind believes something and, you know, you're going to do that, you'll fucking do it. You know, just like you're being dragged by your head and your body follows. So, you know, the fact that it kind of taught you that, you know, whatever you put your mind to is achievable, that's a fucking pretty big moment, man. You know?
Yeah, and I guess for me, Nate, like as a kid, a big mentor of mine was my big brother. So it would be pissing down with rain, and you know what Christchurch rain is like. You know, and we were, I think I was 12, my brother would have been 15, we were biking to judo.
Yep.
And I looked at him, and he saw the look in my eye, like, why the fuck are we doing this? And he said to me, he goes, so the people we compete against are probably training 3 times a week. So he said, if they're training 3 times a week, we have to do 5.
Yeah, bro.
And I looked at my brother and I said, okay, he's my idol. I will do whatever the fuck he says. And then my brother ended up, he ended up fighting in the pro circuit. He's trained with guys like Dan Hooker,
yeah.
Kai Kara France, like pretty household names.
Mm-hmm.
And he's did okay himself. Now he does jiu-jitsu and he's got his own dojo out of Newland. And he works at Dan Hooker's gym. So I guess for me, I've always had people who have told me things. And as a kid, I always kind of absorbed it. And I was like, okay, how can I interpret what they're saying into my actions?
Pretty cerebral motherfucker, bro, I've got to say. You're, the way you pull information and don't just let it slide, like, a lot of us hear things and think, oh, that's good. But then we don't take the next step and go, how can I incorporate that in what I'm doing to make myself perform better? Which is, I think, the step that you've sort of really shown that you do kind of quite religiously.
Yeah. And I guess it's very interesting that you use the word cerebral because a good friend of mine, Dan Hooker, I was talking to him not long ago. And when we had a chat, he said that he considers himself a cerebral fighter and a cerebral coach. And I've been coached by him. I've watched him coach and just detail after detail after detail. You know, and that to me was kind of like, okay, this is my language.
Nice, nice. It's fucking, it's like to me, watching someone operate at that level is like watching a master painter painting, you know, like they're just so meticulous. They cover off all the bases and you kind of sit there and just a little bit in awe. You know, you've got to kind of put that awe to one side so that you can soak up what's going on, but they're a master of their craft essentially.
Yeah. And I guess, that's something that I firmly believe in. So you kind of just talked about, mastering a craft. So I think the biggest issue within strength and conditioning and within the fitness industry we have is too many people try and be jack of all trades and master of none.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, even though I'm a powerlifter, I'm not a powerlifting coach. That's not my thing. I don't coach powerlifters specifically.
Mm-hmm.
It's not what I truly enjoy. What I enjoy is helping athletes.
Yep.
And powerlifting is a sport. They are strength athletes, but for me, it's just kind of like, that's my sacred thing. That's what I do. So I don't want it to get old.
Yep.
So that's why I don't train any powerlifters.
Yeah. Yeah. I've said that before. People say to me, why don't you personal train? And I've said, because the gym's my time.
Yeah.
And when I'm in there, I enjoy myself. It's my fucking special place where I can be amongst my fucking thoughts without too much carnage going on and I can get shit done. And I don't want to ever think of that as a job or a burden. So for me, I kind of steered away from that. And like, I guess like with you with your powerlifting, you know, your powerlifting's your thing, and you specialize in something, you know, slightly different, which, you know, a lot of the skills and the learning that you take from that comes across, but you're not having to teach the same thing every day and then go and learn it yourself.
Exactly. So I guess the biggest thing when it comes to strength and conditioning is I believe in generalizing first. So me, you and Mike spoke about before, it's kind of like training. My idea is you can't compete. You can't do one show and call yourself a bodybuilding specialist coach or do bodybuilding training for a year and call yourself a transformation specialist.
Yeah.
It's just like you can't cheat the system.
Yeah.
You know, there's levels to this game. So in my opinion, I guess it's one of those things where you have to earn your stripes. You have to have your time under the bar.
Yeah. I think that's one of the things that Mike and I very much agree on. I quite like the sciencey stuff. I've got the science background and I like the research and all that. But I also truly believe that without your time in the trenches, you know, your word's not really worth a lot when it comes to that. So I kind of say my ideal coach is the guy in a lab coat with 20-inch arms, you know? So good way of summarizing it, I suppose. Hey, look, what we might do is just quickly jump across. I just want to have a look at your Insta and your website, just so people can see who you are. So just bringing that one up there. So for those people that want to follow Bryn, Samurai Strength, and it's got some cool stuff on. It's got lots of videos, bro. I was having a look through your videos. There's some cool shit on there. Oh, and then the boys. But yeah, there's some really good videos. There's some quite cool photos of some celebs with you. But there's some good stuff in there. I had a bit of a dig down.
A celeb like Tom Mack there.
Tom Mack is in bodybuilding circles is God. Everyone knows that. Yeah, there's some cool stuff. Lots of rolling and stuff in there. So if you're interested in fight sports and strength and conditioning, jump on board on that one. And if you're interested in Bryn's services, he's got his webpage here, samuraistrength.com, and it's got all the info that you can have a look through there. Talks about Bryn's powerlifting successes. I still can't get over the lifts you did, bro. I just, yeah, massive, man, massive. And some videos here too. Awesome.
Yeah, I hope to exceed them soon, Nate. So,
I know. You always
You know, it's one of those things where I'm never happy with, you know what it's like. You get to 90 kg, you get to 100 kg, and it's like, where to from here?
Yeah. Hey, and you're doing a podcast as well, Samurai Speaks. Is that right?
So I haven't done one in a while, but...
Yeah.
The next one that I've got lined up is again with Dan Hooker.
Yeah, that'll be good, man. I actually spotted that before and I thought that it would be, look, if you're into fight sports and Xavier, talking to you, buddy, go and check that out. I know Xavier loves, Dan Hooker as well. So, it'd be good to hear from him. But you go through there, check that stuff out. Right, Bryn, should we, get to brass tacks and talk about, what is the difference in terms of, you know, training an athlete or a fighter versus training a bodybuilder? Because, look, I can train a bodybuilder quite happily. Yep. I can train a powerlifter and a strongman quite happily. But if you said to me, look, can you train a kid that's doing jiu-jitsu or a kid that's doing boxing? I'd kind of go, I don't know. A little bit vague, you know?
Yeah, okay, so... As an example, we'll use your son as an example. So the biggest difference is, as an athlete, you train movements, not muscles.
Yep.
Right? So in bodybuilding, it's all about feeling the working muscle. Yeah, you use heavy weight, but you're trying to target a certain muscle. So if you're doing dumbbell rows, you don't want to be feeling in your bicep because that's otherwise you're just moving the weight.
Can we just highlight that point to people, man? Like I say it about bodybuilding all the time. It's not the movement you're training, it's the muscle. But when we come to athletes, it's not how an athlete looks, it's how an athlete performs. And so it's about training the movement, yeah?
Yeah. So pretty much all my athletes, when I first start with them, I have a system, and I wrote it down. So I have a system that I've developed that I guess helps me identify a lot of people's weaknesses. So the reason why we do something like that is whatever predisposition or weakness they have structurally. So if they have, for example, a weak left glute or a weak left hamstring or, you know, weak rotator cuffs, in my mind, when they get into impact or under pressure in scenarios that will make these areas work harder, it's kind of going to be vulnerable, you know, and susceptible to injury. So my whole thing is structural balance. And I guess I learned a lot of this through having my own chiropractor. So I've had my own chiropractor, Chris, for 4 years now. And when I first did my back, it was about 4 weeks out from a GPC competition. And I messaged Jordan Earl and I said, my back's fucked. What should I do? He said, go see a chiro. You won't regret it. And I do listen to him because he's a good mate of mine. And I couldn't deadlift for 4 weeks. And that at that meet, I pulled 280.
Damn. Hey, for those people down your way, what's your chiro's name? I'm sure there's a
Chris
ton.
Cannon from SportsMed on BLEF.
There you go, guys. Chris Cannon, SportsMed. If you're busted up like most of us are in some way, shape, or form, go
see, him and you'll be able to deadlift 280 kilos guaranteed.
Love it.
Yeah, so I guess Nate and Mike, like I learned a lot from him because he said to me, he was like, oh, this is wrong with your body. These are the structural imbalances you have. And because he told me that, I knew how to work on them because that's my job.
Yep.
I know how to strengthen. So I became fascinated with that side of things. So I incorporated that into my system. And I've got my own mobility coach as well. Elliot Connolly at Snap Fitness, the Palms. He's one of the best judo athletes in New Zealand as well. And he's one of the coaches that looks after me whenever I've done judo. And I guess for me, Nate, just kind of going back to the whole athlete thing, for me, when you are surrounded by top level athletes, it's kind of, you can't help but soak in all this knowledge, you know, and then you talk with them. Oh, what's your training like? Oh yeah, this is how I train. And then it kind of, I'm a cerebral guy. So I start to think. So I guess the biggest thing for any athlete is you have to establish like a strength base. That's pretty much a given.
Yep.
So any athlete I work with, we do muscle testing. So like I said, we achieve structural balance and then that will dictate like the kind of warm-ups they do. So remedial exercises. So for example, if they have rotator cuff issues, of course, they're going to be doing rotator cuff exercises. If they have ankle mobility issues, of course, they're going to be doing ankle mobility drills and things like that.
Is your diagnostic testing in that isolating the muscles? Because you talk about training movements rather than muscles. When you're doing that assessment or diagnostic work on where the weak points are, do you start isolating those muscle groups?
Yeah, so all my testing, Mike, is it's all isolating that muscle group to see how strong it is against force. So as an example, one of the hamstring tests I use is simple knee flexion. So you get someone lying on the ground, you do a single leg curl with them against your hand. And I've had this happen. So someone's left side, very, very strong. You do it on the right side, it comes down like butter. So that tells me there's an issue right there of needing to do single leg work.
Yeah, I've always been told that the major causes of injury are usually either a strength imbalance or a flexibility imbalance across a joint, you know, one side or the other. Strong on one side, weak on the other, you're risking injury. Tight on one side, loose on the other, risking injury.
Yeah, pretty much. Because what happens when you are under force or in impact, if the muscle or the structure isn't strong enough to withstand it, it's going to get injured. Or if you're doing a lift and your force is shifted to one side and that side is overloaded, of course, you're going to get injured. Like a perfect example is, did you guys see that video on Larry Wheels' Instagram?
I haven't seen it. It was peak injury.
Yeah,
I haven't seen it.
Yeah, so that's a perfect example of using a weight that the guy couldn't control at all.
Is that the guy in Dubai, Ryan?
Yeah.
Dave asked me, he said, oh, have you seen the video? And I said, I don't watch videos like that because it fucks with my mental game, you know? But look, it does, bro. If I'm pushing it on bench, the last thing I want to think about is fucking, you know, the catastrophic effects of things going wrong, you know?
Yeah, but I guess, so pretty much for me, I guess a few of my philosophies are movement over muscles for athletes, establishing a movement base. So when I mean a movement base, so all my programs are pretty much squat, hip hinge, upper body push, upper body pull, lower body pull as well. So that'll be knee flexion. We're going to do rotations in there and we're going to do a carry. So a carry is ideally, if you have access, it will be like your anvils or bag carries or things like that. So the reason why I asked you, Nate, is especially for your son, bag carries and things like that are real good for jiu-jitsu.
Yep.
And your grip and just being able to hold that position of your hands together.
I found an anvil the other day. I was at a mate's house and walked into a shed to see his Harley. And right when I walked in, there was a huge anvil and it was one of the ones that are 160 kilos. And I remember carrying that one at New Zealand's Strongest Man and doing pretty well in it. And I sort of pushed it with one hand and went, no, I'm not going to try that now. I won't push Dave in the direction of that one. But bag carries, man. Good stuff. I see Colm Wolf is starting to throw a few of those into his training at the moment.
Yeah, it's just one of those things. Like, I guess that kind of training is pretty applicable to anyone if you want to do something at the end of your workout. But yeah, typically for fighters, so it all depends on their level and their workload. So as an example, we'll use your son as an example. Mm-hmm. So you told me he rolls anywhere from, you know, 4 to 5 days a week.
Yeah.
And he does his own cardio. So for me, as a fighter, the fight training is the most important thing. Mm-hmm. And then you go with, okay, where do we fit in the weights and what aspects do they need to work on? So for me, I know you and I had this friendly discussion. So in my opinion, Xavier's 16. If you have him doing one upper and one lower a week, that's not enough stimulation for a young kid who's trying to grow into a weight class.
Yep.
So if you're trying to grow into a weight class, you want to be training around 3 times a week.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. You know, and I don't mean splitting them up. So if I was to train your son, mm-hmm. basically what I would do is I would do 2 full body strength sessions and 1 strongman kind of circuit session.
Yep.
So that's strongman kind of circuit session. Like I told you, you can do it in many different ways, but you do. So some things that I've done for some fighters in the past have basically been 5 minute rounds, 1 minute, 5 exercises.
Yep.
And then you rest 30 seconds and then you repeat that 4 times.
Sounds fucking brutal, bro, from a bodybuilder's perspective. I'm looking at it going,
oh, yeah.
Holy shit, that would kill me.
But then when you look at it, it's one of those things. So for a lot of fighters, and this is where I guess a lot of coaches and a lot of new people wanting to get into strength and conditioning go wrong, is that it's great to get a mentorship and pay for a mentorship by an established fight coach.
Mm-hmm.
But what a lot of these people don't understand is a lot of these established fight coaches or fight S&C coaches, they've fought, they've grappled, they've boxed, they've actually done it.
Yeah.
So for me, getting a mentorship is all well and good. But the question that I'd ask these people is, do you know what it feels like to have someone on top of you trying to choke you out, trying to take your back, you know, hand fighting? Do you know what it's like to blow your arms out? If you don't, that's probably your priority. Because, you know, my thing is you need to be able to empathize with the people you're working with. You know, and if you don't know what it feels like to get hit, or something that I learned from Coach Carl Weber, Coach Hostile. So he said to me when I was training with him, he said, if you have a guy up against the cage, he said, and you're holding him, wait to hear him breathe. And he said, on the time that he gets his breath in, punch him in the stomach. And you don't learn these things unless you actually go see a fight coach and you're doing the training.
I think you, what you're pointing out for, to me kind of really resonates, because I look at it from the perspective of when guys are getting prepped for a show by someone who hasn't done a show.
Yeah.
I'm like, how does that prep coach empathize with that person when they're going through those stages that the brain doesn't work, you're doubting yourself, you fucking think you're going to die, and all those kind of things if you haven't been through it. So if you haven't been fucking punched in the face repetitively and choked out and had your arms hyperextended, how do you train someone that that's the norm for them?
Yeah, and that's precisely that. So my thing is, like, it's all well and good having the knowledge, but you can't cheat the system again. So I guess I have an issue having had to do an internship myself. So when I first started in Japan, I was on a holiday, and Ash Jones said to me, he's like, right, you can come do an internship with me for a month on one condition. And I said, okay, what's that condition? You have to start in the gym with me 4:30 a.m. every single morning. This was in winter in Japan where it snowed. It was raining. And I said to him, I was like, okay, fuck, I'll do it. And this was, I was sleeping on my mate's floor. You know, but I had that determination. I was like, this guy is giving me a chance. I will do whatever it takes to get that chance. And then that's how I eventually got the job. Yeah. So I guess for me, my thing is, if you persist and if you do the hard work, you'll eventually get there. So I don't see how these people these days, especially with social media, you know, there's very different to our day. I guess when I first met you, we didn't have that. It was either you worked hard or you're a pussy, you know.
Mm-hmm. Hard, bro.
Simpler times.
Suit simple men like me. Mike, I know you had some questions for Bryn around training.
Look, I mean, you've answered a few of them along the way, because I know nothing about, you know, how a training week or day would be structured. So I mean, it sounds like it's quite individual depending on where the weaknesses are for the athletes.
Yeah.
But I was sort of, for the sort of ignorant person like myself, what sort of percentage of your training week or your training session would be cardio, skills-based stuff, or resistance training? Or do you kind of tend to combo them both? It sounds like the strongman rounds will be hot, pretty cardiovascular, but also endurance.
So I guess it all depends on the individual, Mike. So I can use myself personally as an example. So when I got back into judo at the start of last year, just because I needed a bit of a break from powerlifting, like my competitive year in 2019 wasn't that great. So I wanted to get back to martial arts to further my knowledge for training fighters. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of why I spent that year just doing a lot of martial arts. So for me, I was unfit as anything. You go from powerlifting back into fighting. I had no cardio.
Yep.
I was like the Tin Man.
Right, I can relate. I went from strongman to jiu-jitsu, and I trained three times a week, and I spewed up three times a week for 5 weeks straight before I stopped spewing up. That's how fucking different the conditioning was. So,
yeah,
I hear you, bro.
So I guess, yeah, it all depends on the individual, but you can have, so I've trained a friend of mine who's a Samoan heavyweight. He's an amateur going on the cusp of pro, very, very strong guy, but lacks the conditioning and lacks the footwork. So a lot of what I have told him to do in his boxing sessions away from me is to get his boxing coach to take him through a lot of footwork drills. You know, and then when he comes to me, we've done a lot of footwork and directional change just to make sure that he moves on his feet properly, because with boxing and striking in general, everything comes from the ground. So if you don't know how to transfer your force accurately onto your opponent, you're not going to be able to, I guess, give them as much damage as you can. You know, and that, so an example can be you're punching with your arm and shoulder versus using your whole body. And that's something that I've learned along the way. And I've trained with a friend of mine in Australia, Steve Moxon. He was a world champion kickboxer. And
Stone Cold Steve Moxon.
Yeah, yeah. So he's a mate of mine. And I went and trained with him. And these are the things that I've done, Nate, because that was after Pro Raw. So I competed in Pro Raw. And the next day I went to Geelong on an hour train. And I said to him, I was like, mate, I just competed. I don't give a fuck. Take me through a session. But my mindset is I want to learn as much as I can.
Yeah.
So I understand what the people that I train need to do. You know? So just going back to your question, Mike, is typically it all depends on the rounds. So you've got the energy system, so you've got your ATP PC, you got your glycolytic, and you've got your oxidative. So depends on the person. So if you have someone who has good endurance and they can go the rounds, but they lack power, then strength is going to be the thing that they need to work on, strength and power. But if you have someone who's the opposite, kind of like myself, then you will still maintain and work on your strength, but your conditioning and your ability to apply that power repetitively over rounds will be your focus.
Yeah, one of the things that two fight coaches that I really respect, so Steve Oliver and also Kev Honey Badger, so if you know either of them, they both said to me very similar things, essentially saying that strength and technique together are a lethal combination. And I think you sort of pointed out that you can be a very strong guy, and I found this out the hard way, and you go into a jiu-jitsu type situation or a fighting situation, and you can't actually apply that strength to the activity you're doing because, you know, either technically or your, you know, aerobic capacity is just balls like mine was. So, you know, how do you ensure that the strength that they're getting through training is directly transferable to their actual activity of fighting?
Yeah, so I guess it's one of those things where transferability is the most important. So that's where exercise selection and execution comes into play. So I don't care if you can deadlift 300 kg, if you can't hold a gi or hold your opponent down, it's no use to me. Yeah. So what we focus on is the aspects of the sport. So an example could be, you know, grip strength is something that's very important in grappling and in MMA in general. So doing exercises that transfer over, that give you strength, but also give you the necessary physical characteristics that you need for your martial art is important. So an example could be trap bar deadlift is extremely important for fighting, because you're in a more upright position, it's a bit more quad dominant, and it works the hell out of your grip. And also, similar thing with, you know, sled drags or prowler pushes or things like that. You're pushing against resistance, you know, and I guess the whole transferability thing comes down to if you are stronger in a certain movement pattern that is used in your sport, I guarantee you will be stronger anyway.
Yeah, man. Look, it sounds like fascinating. I'd love to know more. Something that I really, I feel well out of my depth, but like most guys in bodybuilding, powerlifting, strongman, we all enjoy watching, you know, all the combat sports. Most of us in awe at these guys, the condition that they're in and in terms of the performances they put on. But it's certainly a lot more complex than bodybuilding in my eyes. You know, I'm sort of thinking there's a lot more to factor into the equation.
Yeah, and I guess it's one of those things where, so an example could be, if you want to work on your rotational strength or your core strength from the side, doing a side plank or something like that may be good to warm up with, but doing a side plank for your obliques isn't really going to transfer too much. Versus if you do something like a suitcase deadlift, that's extremely transferable because you've got the weight distributed on one side of your body, you're having to stay upright, and it kind of mimics the motion of someone trying to pull you down, and you have to resist that with your core. You know, so these are the things that you need to think about, and I guess things that I think about are, you know, front squats. So safety bar squats, you know how they pull you forward, right?
As I found out the other day, doing them for the second or third time in 2 years, they just fucking buckle you with the camber, eh? Yeah.
So because they pull you forward, it kind of forces you to stay more upright and get your upper back a bit tighter, which is important because if someone gets you in a clinch and your upper back collapses and your head is down, looking at their knee, you're fucked. You know, so these are the kind of things that I look at. And I guess, you know, so, I've managed fighters as well. I've sent a lot of fighters to Japan. And through that relationship, I've had people ask me, hey, this is what I'm doing for my strength and conditioning. What do you think of it? And I've consulted to a couple of them and, you know, they've gone a bit better. But the most important thing is knowing that all the training you're doing throughout the week has a purpose. So the key word is basically intent. So when you go into the gym, I'm sure hoping that you have an idea of what exactly you need to do during that session, what your numbers are, what muscle you're trying to feel, what 100%. The goal is for that particular session, right? So if someone comes to me and says, oh yeah, I want to get fitter, but doesn't specify what they want to do, I don't really have an idea of what their intent is. You know,
so it's about crystallizing what your intent actually is. What are you trying to achieve?
So what do you want to be able to do that you can't do now?
Yeah, pretty much. So I guess another topic that I want to talk about is, we've seen fighters gas out within the first round.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have a sufficient enough aerobic capacity and also an anaerobic capacity, it's not something that should happen, because it happens more so with the inexperienced guys, the guys who don't know how to pace themselves.
Mm.
So Nate, did you follow much of the early UFC or not really?
Bits and pieces, bro, bits and pieces.
Do you remember a guy called Phil Baroni?
No.
So I'll tell you a funny story about him. He was an ex-bodybuilder, amateur bodybuilder, wrestler, and then got into MMA. And he did a video about 10 years ago. And someone said, Phil, who do you work with for strength and conditioning? And he said, fuck strength and conditioning coaches. He's like, I do my own training in here. And he's like, have you seen the way that I look? Have you seen my muscles? And he was a good fighter back in the day, but he was one of those guys overly muscled, extremely explosive and powerful, but just gas out. Like
early days of Marius Pudzianowski's transfer from strongman to powerlifting. I saw him go purple in a match and just basically give up. And then, you know, going down the track, obviously had the win against Gracie, etc. But he had dropped probably 15 kilos of muscle and become he had to change what he had in order to be able to compete in that, because, you know, what he had in strongman wasn't directly transferable to his MMA career. Mm.
Yeah, so it all comes down to, have you heard of the SAID principle? So SAID.
What's that one for, bro?
So specific adaptation to impose demands.
No. Took a short break.
What that basically means, this is something I learned off Westside Barbell.
Yep.
So Louis Simmons trains a lot of MMA fighters.
Yep.
And I remember him talking about doing a circuit that was 5 5-minute rounds with 30 seconds in between. But his gym is laid out ideally for a fighter because you can go from one station to the next, to the next, to the next, to the next, because it's not a public gym. You know, but for the people that I train, I try and set that up within the means that I have.
No, I hear you, man, because, you know, like even getting two bits of equipment to do a giant set in bodybuilding can be pretty hard work in a commercial gym, you know?
I guess it's just knowing what you need to work on and how you need to train, I guess. Like I said, it's one of those things from the whole Westside Barbell thing. It's that the weak point training.
Yeah, bro. That resonated with me, actually, when you said that. The first thing I thought of was Louis Simmons, and I thought, you know, their whole principles were about finding the weak points, bringing up the weak points, and then working out what the new weak point was and bringing that up. So it was a constant process of building a stronger machine, essentially.
Yeah. So I guess my thing is, I don't believe in, if someone has a strength, you don't just completely disregard the strength and work on all their weaknesses, because then you're not nurturing that strength.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
You know, so if someone... So, an example, we can use the guy that I trained. So, Samoan heavyweight boxer, extremely strong dude, but he's very, very strong, but he's not good at repeating those efforts of strength.
Yep.
So, something that I did with him was we did... have you heard much about lactate training?
Over to Mike. Yep.
Yep.
So have you heard much about lactate training, Mike?
Yeah, so manipulating your rest intervals to stack lactate or remove lactate. Yeah.
So pretty much what I did with this big guy, because he was very strong for one set and then you rest a couple minutes and repeat kind of thing. So I said to him, I said, you think about it this way. What's the point of going in to the pocket, because he's a boxer, and being able to do a few combos, but then stepping out and being so gassed that you can't repeat that until, you know, the round's almost over. Because that's pretty much what was happening in the gym. So what I said to him was, okay, what we're going to do is we're going to do a circuit. So we did upper body push, upper body pull, lower body push, lower body pull. Then we did 1 minute on the assault bike. And we did that for 5 rounds.
Yeah, I think I'm going to stick to bodybuilding, bro. It sounds brutal, but look, you know, as they always say, the more you sweat in training, the less you bleed in battle, bro. So,
yeah, it's just one of those things, Nate. I guess, like, fighting's one of those sports where you have to be prepared for anything. So, your ability to be able to repeat those intense efforts is very important.
Yep.
But being able to, this is where I guess people get a lot very blurred. So I don't have anything, I leave all the fighting stuff to the fight coach. Yep. I'm not a fight coach. That's not, you know, the fight coach will tell them their strategy and their game plan and things like that. What my job is to work on all their physical characteristics so they have the physical capacity to be able to apply...
Execute that fight plan.
Yeah, to be able to apply the fight plan and what the coach said. So an example can be, you know, it's one of those things where I've noticed in a lot of people, and I've had a rugby player do it recently too, if you strengthen the hamstrings, the posterior chain, it's going to be pretty hard to take you down if you've got a strong pair of hamstrings and glutes and lower back. And especially, and this is one of the things too, where a lot of people don't understand, is if someone is doing a lot of wrestling training and someone is doing a lot of sprawling, that puts a lot of strain on their lower back. So with training a fighter or training any athlete in general, you have to always be able to adapt to the plan. So I had that today, actually, at work. I had a rugby player. When he came and saw me earlier in the week, he had played 40 minutes. He has a prop, bit of contact. He told me his shoulder was stiff. And we were supposed to do high bar squats.
Yeah, yeah.
So we changed it to safety bar.
Yep.
Ideally, in the perfect world, I would have used a cambered bar.
Yeah, to take that load out, eh?
Yeah, to take that load out. So these are the things that, as a strength and conditioning coach, this is what makes a strength and conditioning coach different from a normal personal trainer. Is it's more about problem solving. So you have to be able to think on the spot, because what I don't understand is, you know, a very good example is if someone has a fight on a Saturday and they win the fight within a minute, a knockout. Does it make sense for them to take that whole week off the week after and not do any training? Probably not.
No.
Whereas if they had a battle for five-minute rounds and they come out of it pretty black and blue, that's a different story. Then you might want them to rest a couple of days and then ease their way back into training.
Yeah.
And this is where I guess I learned this philosophy through my mentor, Ash Jones, because he said to me, he made the system when we were in Japan, and he said, right, I'm going to create a system and I want you to follow closely. He said, what people do the week after a game or a match will be dictated by how much fatigue they have from the weekend of their game or match. So we had a system where it was 0 to 20 minutes, 20 to 40, 40 to 60, 60 to 80.
Yep.
So whatever bracket of time they were in would dictate how much volume and intensity they would do on the Monday.
Yeah, man. Which is very different to, say, for someone training with a personal trainer, regardless if they're a sportsman or not, that they come in and they've got a set program and that happens regardless of anything else, and kind of forgets about the aspect of...
I know the Otago team were having to chart their fluid intake and everything on the next couple of days as well. So they'd come in on Monday morning and they'd factor that into how much load or how much volume they'd do during that week, depending on how well they'd recovered with respect to their fluid and food intake, that sort of thing. So take it to another level again, above and beyond just the load they'll put in on the Saturday.
Yeah, so when we were in Japan, we had a recovery system. So it was pretty much on the Sunday, all the players who played would come in for recovery, and every mode of recovery would be 10 points. And you had to rack up 100 points in order to be able to leave the clubhouse. So a protein shake was 10 points. Foam rolling was 10, you know, hot and cold shower was 10, things like that.
Fuck, that's great, bro. It's great. It's just a great concept. I like it.
You know, and it's interesting because this is what you and Mike will find very funny. So for years, I have been talking to my bodybuilding friends and bodybuilders and said progressive overload is the most important thing when it comes to adaptation or muscle growth.
Yeah.
For years, people were telling me, oh, you're just a powerlifter. You're just telling us to chase the numbers. And fuck me daisies. These days, everyone's talking about, oh, deadlifts, oh, squats, oh, beat the logbook. It's nothing new.
No.
You know, people are just trying to reinvent the wheel.
That's it. Look. Every generation comes out with the same thing, but with a different label. And look, what I'm doing now, you know, people go, oh, it's kind of the new school way of training. I'm thinking, well, you know, 30 years ago, we kind of did something similar when we were powerlifting anyway. So, you know, there's nothing new. It's just, you know, a bit of new terminology and a few fancy changes in there. But I have to agree, you know, and I think progressive overload is a great concept for obviously strength athletes. Obviously, a lot of bodybuilders heading down that pathway now. But for fighters, you think progressive overload is the trick?
Yeah, to a degree. Like it all depends on. So you can manipulate progressive overload in terms of rest periods and things like that as well, for what you're trying to achieve. Yeah. So it's not just about load. So for a lot of fighters, Like I said, structural balance is key. Joint integrity is key.
It just so I'm kind of clear on it. So like for myself, as a bodybuilder, progressive overload to me is about beating the numbers, beating the weight, or beating the form in which I completed that exercise. If I was a strength athlete, or a fighter, would I be looking at things like progressive overload by decreasing time between sets? Would that be something?
Yeah, so it all basically depends on where the person's at and what you're trying to achieve. So there's nothing new here, but say, depending on the block of training they were in, and say they had a strength session, within that strength session, you will be trying to break new ground on that movement.
Yep.
If that is the purpose of that session, if the purpose of the session is to beat a certain time on a circuit, that's what you'll be aiming for.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
So even if I have someone doing a circuit, and we'll use this as an example. So I have, it's not originally mine. I got it handed down to me by my mentor, Ashley Jones. So it's called the Beastly Circuit. So number of the beast, 666. So 6 exercises, 6 reps, 6 sets, back to back, with one or two kettlebells. And with a minute of cardio on the end too, nonstop.
Jeepers.
I've done it before. Yep. And typically, it will take you anywhere between 25 and 30 minutes.
So you could go into that, you know, the next time you attempt that, you'd be looking at doing it in a quicker time or with more weights or getting a better cardio output at the end of that session. Any of those things depending on what you're chasing?
Yeah. So pretty much what we do is, an example is, someone could start with a 12 kg kettlebell.
Mm-hmm.
And because they're not used to that kind of training, it's very, very rare that someone who isn't used to that kind of training will get through all 6 rounds with ease.
I've had to pull people
out at like round 4.
Just because
the execution and the technique is hindered by the fatigue.
Yep.
So for a lot of people, progressive overload is going from 4 rounds to 5 rounds to 6 rounds. And then once you get to 6 rounds, it's going from 12 kg kettlebell to 14.
Yeah, cool.
You know, and then the modes of cardio. So for a lot of people, I have liked to mix it up. So I've done things like got them on the bike, got them on the rower. And if they're really game, we get them on the assault bike. But again, those are all kind of progressive overload forms of cardio that you can do, because the way that you do them also gets harder. And it also depends on, so the minute of cardio, it can either be a minute at 110 plus RPM on the spin bike, or I can do it, if I really want to be cruel, I can do 60 to 80 RPMs on the bike, but it has to be a climb. Yeah, so they have to crank the resistance up.
Oh, bro, way too brutal for me, man. Hey, Mike.
Just got a couple more things. You've actually answered, like, I had a whole list of questions here. You've already answered most of them. So just had a couple of little things. Is it common, I mean, you don't do the fight training, but to get the athletes really, really fatigued through their muscular endurance or cardiovascular work and then get them to try and execute skill stuff, does that happen in their fight and their rolling sessions?
Yes, so it's actually very interesting that you say that, because when I did my judo training, and this is very recently, we used to do training like that. So my coach, he's currently getting ready to qualify for the Olympics, Jason Costa. And we did a lot of training like that. So you would do 20 seconds on, 10 seconds off of, say, like a resistance drill, and then you might do a bodyweight drill, and then you might do actual judo throws or uchikomi. So uchikomi is pretty much practicing to get in for the throw. So you're doing all these things under fatigue and duress because that's the way that you're going to be competing and training as well. But my thing is, so I've done this with fighters before too. So you have a system, and I know a lot of coaches have the system where if someone's getting ready, you'll have them, their back against the wall, and you'll have fresh fighters coming in one after the other trying to peel them off. So what that does is basically it gives you that fight or flight, but it also forces you to execute that technique while you're having fresh bodies and you're fatigued. It's just a different feeling. Like I've done all this kind of training, and this is what I'm talking about, Mike, is I can emote and I can empathize with these fighters because I've gone through that kind of training myself. And when you it's hard to explain, but when you hear the clock counting down from 10 to 1 and your coach is screaming, you know, we've got to get those throws in, you don't really think about the detail. You don't think about, oh, I have to put my hand here. You just go on autopilot and it happens.
And the more precise that autopilot can be, the better execution you get under.
Yeah, pretty much. So this is the thing too. So doing training under duress is important, but having the level of skill to be able to do that is also important. So if your technique deteriorates straight away, then to me, it might be, the priority might be to work on the conditioning, because you're not in a state to be able to maintain your technique under physical duress. You know, so in rugby, as an example, we did this in rugby too. So we did contact drills, so contact conditioning. So I remember my mentor setting up drills with the tackle bags, breakdown drills, and then he would send them straight over to me and he would say, take them for 2 minutes of conditioning. And then I'd take them for 2 minutes conditioning, 12, 22s, or you do, do you guys know what the Malcolm drill is?
Never.
Okay, so the Malcolm drill is an old rugby league drill. So you're belly down on the halfway.
Yep.
You get up, you backpedal to 10 meters, down up.
Yeah.
You run to the far 10 meters, down up.
No, I've done those.
To halfway.
Yeah,
down
I did
up,
those.
That's one.
Yeah, did those with when I played for Otago. That was fucking horrific. It used to kill me.
Yeah, so you do six of those. That's one Malcolm.
Yeah.
And then they would have to go into their rugby drill pretty much straight away.
Yeah.
Or a little water break and then straight into the rugby drill. So all these kind of things are, I guess, the biggest thing that I can tell you, Mike, is fatigue is the biggest killer of decision making, right? In terms of sport. And the most important thing in any sport is decision making, or your ability to process detail and make decisions within a split second.
Was it Mike Tyson that said everyone's got a plan until they get punched in the face?
Yeah, pretty much.
Right? Yeah. Oh, so, I mean, you've given me bad memories now of rugby league training sessions and fuck how horrific and actually it kind of makes me realise that you know, when we watch these, you know, rugby players, rugby league players, fighters, you know, when we watch them perform, just how much fucking work they do to get to that point, you know. And I think it's pretty easy to forget that when you're an armchair critic like myself. But must be really rewarding to be the guy that fucking gets to work with some of these guys and watch them progress through their careers and actually see the improvement they're making when it comes to D-Day and they're in the ring or they're out playing rugby or whatever it is.
Yeah, look, I've had one guy who I work with in Japan. He fought in Pancras. He fought at 59 kgs.
Yeah.
And we linked up on Instagram. And when I went to Japan, I caught up with him. And he said to me, you know, he was like, oh, I'm quite weak in the grapple. I don't feel like I have a whole lot of KO power. What do you think I need to work on? And he was also putting like crazy things up on his Instagram of 1 hour of interval training, you know, sprints by the river. So I replied to him and I said, right, so when are we going to meet up and when are we going to sort this out? So he sat down with him and I said, okay, what are your goals as a fighter? And he told me his goals as a fighter. This is in 2018. And I said to him, right, so what's your training schedule like? And the amount of volume this guy was already doing in terms of fight training,
yeah.
I kind of said to him, okay, fuck, you're only going to be able to do 2 weight sessions a week. Because I said, if we do any more, it's going to impact your fight training, and that's not what you want from the gym. So he was doing, I think he still does 2 now. So he was doing 2 full body strength sessions a week. That I was programming him for. And we managed to shave his interval training sessions to 15 to 20 minute sessions, but more intensity.
Mm-hmm.
So it's all about looking at the big picture.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, one of the things that, you know, I guess I would look at from a very simplistic point of view is that he's not fighting for an hour.
Yeah.
You know, so your specificity in terms of, you know, the length of those sessions, but also allowing him the ability to have the volume for the resistance training in order to get their knockout power. You know, something has to give in that schedule. So it must be kind of with some people a bit of a balancing act, but with someone like that, you kind of walk in going, if this guy can do interval training for an hour, he's fucking hard as nails. So if I can get him in the right direction and the knowledge, this guy's going to fucking just be dynamite.
Yeah, and pretty much, interesting we talk about that topic of mental fortitude because, you know, I messaged Dan Hooker the other day when he was in isolation and he put up on a story, he clocked up 10 kilometers in his fucking hotel room. He had carpet burn.
Holy shit.
Like, this is what I mean. This is when we're talking cream of the crop MMA fighters, some of the best in the world, their mentality is, when I go in there, I am willing to die. This is how I put food on the table for my family. Yeah. And I messaged him and I said, you crazy motherfucker.
Ish. Fuck. Admirable as shit though, bro. Like, you know, if I could take your head off to anyone that has got the, you know, the tenacity and stickability to do what you have to do to get to that level. And I think it's really cool. It's really exciting in New Zealand at the moment, like having that kind of, that pathway's kind of been created and we're starting to channel some of our talent into the limelight. And I think it's going to be, there'll be a lot more to follow, I think.
Yeah, and it's quite interesting because my next podcast that I'm going to do with Dan is actually going to be about mental fortitude.
Awesome.
Bro, because
keep an eye out for that one.
Yeah, because you and I both know it does require some kind of mental fortitude to lift a certain amount of weight or train a certain way. But if you said to someone, a general member of the general public, that guy clocked up 10Ks in his hotel room. That's pretty surreal, you know?
Yeah,
like, 10Ks is a lot of distance, but this is what I'm saying is a lot of the top fighters, so I'm not talking about amateur or grassroots level guys, a lot of the top fighters have that mentality.
Yeah, I think like when you get people like that, like I know that if you gave me someone like Dan Hooker or someone that had that mental fortitude, you know I could make him a top bodybuilder. I know I could make him a top powerlifter. I know I could make him a top strongman because he's got something that the average person hasn't got that allows him to do things that the average person couldn't do. And I think that kind of trait that you're talking about The trait that allows you to do 10Ks and get fucking carpet burn in a hotel room is the kind of thing that all elite athletes have to have, regardless really of sport or anything.
Yeah, so I guess it's one of those things where you can teach skill. And this is what Coach Carl Weber said to me. He said, I can teach you skill, but I can't teach you heart. And this is kind of rings true. So you'll understand too. And this kind of rings true to any kind of sport or physical activity. And you know, within bodybuilding, when you get to that point where you want to rack the weight, but your mind's saying no, but your body's saying, Nate, we've got two more reps in us. What are you going to do? Are you going to pump them out and then rack it, or are you going to rack it prematurely?
I'll keep going until I can't fucking rack it.
Yeah, and that's the thing. And that's why I guess we're all here and we're all talking, because we all have that similar mindset. And I guess you too, Mike, you've done bodybuilding. You've had your career. Like, you've been there, done that. So I guess for me, it's one of those things where we're all talking about a subject where we can relate to. And you all both know that, especially with bodybuilding, it's a mixture of, especially at elite level, it's a mixture of the right genetics and that champion mindset.
Yeah, I think John Davies summed it up well for me. He said that, you know, anyone that has got that fucking drive and instinct, you know, and that will just do whatever they have to do to get there, will achieve to a relatively high level. But once you get on the Olympia stage, then the genetic dispositions and the work ethic come into play, you know, and you don't make it there without either of those two things, you know. And I guess, you know, we've seen that in rugby and that as well. Like, you know, you've got some really just outstandingly talented players. You've got some players that are the hardest working guys on the planet, and that's why they're there. And then you get a guy like, say, McCaw, who has got, you know, the genetic predispositions that, you know, his recovery scores were phenomenal. But he had a work ethic like nobody's business. And that kind of, I think, you know, that very few that have got the mix of both. But I think, to me, it's always been about finding the guys that have got the heart and that, because they're willing to do the work, you know. And we'll see if they've got the genetics further down the track, you know, or if they've got the... In the case of, you know, in fight sports, whether they've got the physical ability to do what they need to do. Without that heart, you're not even going to get this, not even getting started, are you?
And that's what sets a lot of people apart. So I guess my training clientele, I have a couple general population clients.
Yeah.
But, you know, I train a lot of guys and girls who just want to train serious. So I have a young guy who I'm prepping because he directly, so I'm not a prep coach, but I've done it myself.
Yeah.
I know how to do it. And I'm very jealous of how many carbs this guy can have while getting shredded, because I know what I need to do to get shredded. So I've got him on, carb cycling, but on his high day, he has 500 grams of carbs.
How far out is he?
Natural guy, and he's dropped. He's dropped almost 10 kgs and he's getting stronger. And I'm just sitting there. And I had a chat to him the other day and I said, you have the right mix of parents and you have the right brain for bodybuilding. Because, you know, this guy, he just says to me, he says, I'll do whatever you tell me to do. And that's music to my ears, because you both know how rare that is for someone at 22, 23.
Look, honestly, when you find people like that, it's a fucking, it's a joy, man. Like, you know, I've met probably one guy like that since I've been back training in Hawke's Bay for 18 months. One guy that I've come across that I've gone, fuck, this guy's got what it takes, you know. He's fucking leaving no stone unturned.
As a phys ed teacher, I see a ton of kids and I see a ton of talent, but I very rarely see that work ethic combined with it. Most of the people who have a real drive and work ethic are a bit like me, just grafters, you know, not actually that talented. So I've thought and tried to work out how you can integrate both. Have someone who's enormously talented and yet does, you know, looks at the big picture, looks at the big pond instead of feeling like the big fish and going, yeah, I'm good enough. I don't have to work very hard.
Yeah, and to build onto that, it's interesting you say that, Mike, because my mentor, Phil Mooney, who was the guy from the Queensland Reds, he said to me, have you heard of the open mindset or the growth mindset?
Yeah,
so he said to me about this when we were coaching in Japan, and he said, oh, look into this book called The Growth Mindset by Carol Dweck. He said it will help you with your coaching career. And I started to look into it. And there was a study. I'm not sure if you're familiar with the study. But they did a study, and they had two separate groups. So they had one group, which they said, you did well in the test because you were smart. And then they had the other group that said, you did well in the test because you worked extremely hard and you put the effort in. They tested 8 weeks later. The ones who were rewarded on talent scored lower. The ones who were rewarded on effort scored higher. So that is pretty much...
Doesn't surprise me, bro. What's that book? I'm quite interested in that. It's called
The Growth Mindset by Carol Dweck.
Cool.
So D-W-E-C-K.
So when you're... providing positive reinforcement for especially young kids, but athletes, you talk about how hard they've worked and the effort they've put in as opposed to the outcome or the talent or the ability.
Yeah, so what I do and what I've found with a lot of the people that I train is basically it's human nature that if we give too much praise or do too much for most people, people become complacent. That's just the way we're wired. They end up taking things for granted, like in anything in life. So what I found is I will give praise where it's warranted, but the way that I give praise will either be technical or effort-based.
Not outcome.
Yeah, not outcome, but I mean, I guess I don't reward... I don't say, oh, you did that because you're a great player, or you did that because you've got the right parents, or, you know, I try and, I guess, emphasize the fact that, you know, your technique was real good, or you worked real hard, or you've been putting in the effort, or you've been consistent. So I've got a group of boys that I train at the moment, and one of them in the group, I've been training them for less than a year, and one of them in the group got up to 55 kg flat dumbbells for sets of 10.
Nice.
And he's miles ahead of all the other guys.
Yeah.
Fully natural, been training, you know, with me for like maybe 8 months. And I said to him, I said, the reason why you are moving the weights you're moving versus the others in the group are the fact that you have never missed a session. And you'll remember this, Nate. When I first started, Dave Smith said to me, I was a kid and I said to him, what's the best advice you could give me, Dave? And he said, never miss a meal, never miss a workout. And he said, that's half the battle done.
Absolutely, bro. Absolutely.
You know, for a lot of athletes and for a lot of people, training is only one part of the equation. So I guess a lot of fighters, especially professional fighters, they have sponsorships. They have things that... You know, like Dan Hooker's got Go Paleo Meals. I know a couple other fighters hooked up with Muscle Fuel. So they're like robots. This is why they can perform at that level. They don't have to think about, oh, I've got to cook dinner, or I've got to measure my carbs, or, you know?
Yeah, you know, and I look at that and people go, oh, they're so lucky. And I'm like, they're not fucking lucky.
Yeah.
They've made the choices right
to be able to do that.
They had to do to position themselves there. To now be able to do the things they need to do to perform.
So you can guarantee that before someone else was providing the meals, they still didn't miss a meal.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And a similar story, I saw something the other day, and GSP, George St. Pierre, before he made it in the UFC, he was working on a rubbish truck. Fuck. You know, and there's that story of Jimmy Crute in the UFC who still lives off-grid in a camper van with his girlfriend, even though he's making bank in the UFC.
Yeah, yeah.
This is what I'm saying is a lot of the cream of the crop athletes, they give back. you know, and they do things, and you know, it's one of those things where that mentality you have to have at that elite level is few and far between. I don't know how many people have that kind of mentality.
Very few, I would imagine. I did an exercise back when I was a math teacher, Mike. We did a statistical exercise about how many kids played rugby at the high school, how many of those made the first 15, how many of those went on to make the premier side, how many of them made the regionals, who got a Super 12 contract, and who could ultimately make the ABs. And the fucking maths equation on that was a very, very tiny percentage. So those people that could make it in professional as a professional fighter versus all the kids that start off in jiu-jitsu or judo or kickboxing, etc. You know, you're talking, you know, that many, you know? Yeah.
It's interesting, though, because if you're realistic about it, you'd give up straight away, wouldn't you? So you've got to have a sort of unrealistic aspiration to at least to devote everything to something that's, you know, statistically unlikely to happen.
Yeah, well, what I believe in, Mike, is I believe in if you cover all bases, if you do everything you can humanly control and you reach a certain level, you've done everything you can to get to that level. You know? Whereas there's a lot of New Zealand fighters who have been in the game a long time and might not ever get to the UFC. But they've done everything they can to get to the level they're at. So that's the level they will be at.
Yeah, Mike and I have had that conversation, you know, about bodybuilding and saying that, like, sometimes, you know, you do everything in your power to achieve what you can achieve, but the scorecards might not always be what you want. And it is what it is. So, yeah. Focus on the things that you can control, people. Hey, we're going to have to wrap this up because we've sort of dragged you along for a long time now. And,
it's all good.
I'm starting to get hungry.
Same.
Good shit. Look, thank you very much, Bryn, for coming and joining us and really kind of opening my eyes to how much, you know, there is to know in that game. And you know, I think if there's people out there that are fighters that want to develop themselves in terms of strength and conditioning, talk to Bryn. But before we go, Bryn, what we always do is we hand over to you and let you do a bit of a shout out and a thanks to those people that have supported you and helped you along the way and helped you get where you are today.
Yeah, so I guess for me, obviously Dave Smith and Lisa, they have pretty much given me all the bodybuilding knowledge that I have to this day. And that has helped me a lot in terms of, so bodybuilding is very important in fight training as well, because it kind of comes into play where you need to have lactate tolerance in your arms and shoulders and different muscles. So what I would use to describe my method is it's a blend of everything.
Mm.
But it has to have transferability, right? So I want to obviously thank them. And Ashley Jones, my mentor. I've known him for more than half my life. David Neath, my mental skills coach. He has helped me in ways that I never thought were possible for me, in terms of unlocking parts of my brain and controlling the fire. Because I remember at one GPC comp, this is how we linked up. I was running around listening to Disturbed for pretty much the whole meet, back-to-back songs. And he put his hand on my shoulder and he took my earphone out. And he goes, mate, you've been walking around like a madman for the past 30 minutes. When are you on? And I said, oh, I'm on in about 10 minutes. And he goes, bro, chill the fuck out. Do that when you're about to deadlift. And that's when I was like, yeah, I need to talk to that guy.
Yeah,
he was a great guest. Enjoyed having him on the podcast. Probably one of my favorite ones.
Yeah, and I guess shout out to some of my most loyal friends who have my back in the industry. So Kagan Auden, he's my best friend.
Kagan,
at his wedding.
Kagan, we caught up on the weekend. We want to talk to you. We want to talk to you, Kagan. Bryn, you push him. You push that boy.
I'll get him on.
Yeah, I definitely. Him and his brother. You know, they're both really good guys. I want to talk to you. Sorry, carry on.
And my boy Jordan Earl, aka the Freak. Tom Mack. He helped me a lot. Yourself, Nate. You know, you've looked after me countless times when I've been up in Auckland and things like that. I won't forget because you...
Thank you, bro. It's been a pleasure.
You let me sleep on your couch. You took me around. We went out. You took me around Auckland for the first time.
That could have been dangerous.
You know, but to me, I hadn't achieved anything great at that point, but you still believed in me. So I hold that pretty close to my heart.
Awesome, bro.
You know, and appreciate you believed them in, and all that kind of support led me to where I am today. And it's all a collective effort. So I just wanted to say thanks to you for that.
Appreciate it, bro.
And in return, I'll be helping you out with Xavier's program.
Thank you, bro. It means a lot to me. It means a lot to me. And I know Xavier's extremely excited. So, if you're looking for someone who's mentally fucking tough, that boy puts me to shame, brother. So I look forward to that. That'll be choice. Be cool.
Yeah, so and I guess Phil Mooney as well. He'll be the last person. And he helped me with the whole coaching side of things. He is the most detailed rugby coach I have ever met. And he said to me, as your job, as a coach, if you can get your message across to the person you're trying to talk to, that's your job. And he said, if they action what you want them to action based on what you've told them, that's your job done. You know, and he taught me the differences between different types of coaching and different individuals. And that's helped me as a trainer and as a coach within the gym as well.
Yeah, man, and I've got to say, the way you talk really kind of shows me that you're not just providing a consulting service, you're actually genuinely coaching these athletes and helping them achieve their potential. So, fuck, it's been really cool having you, bro, and catch up again soon.
Thanks for coming on,
next
bro.
Time in Crossroads. So.
I'll let you know when I'm in Napier Hastings area.
We're going to be up in Christchurch for the big meet in July with Jackson Hinch's show.
Yeah, bro.
Oh, nice. Yes. We'll catch up then, eh?
Yeah, it'd be good.
Sounds good. Right, people, stay safe out there.